Chief Judge and Judge of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. This morning, for the argument in the case of the United States, the Gurney or both sides prepared?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. In defense, I haven't heard. Are you reserving any time?
Your Honor, 5 minutes.
Very well. You may begin.
Chief Judge Rowe, members of this honorable court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Michael Schrammer, and with Lieutenant Colonel Jane Luner, we represent the appellant in this case, Chief Master Sergeant William Gurney. 1,376 text messages, 522 of which were sent by CH. Pictures sent by both females that of their bodies, to include pictures of their breasts and buttocks. When asked what her favorite sexual position was, CH responded, "I don't have a favorite sexual position. I just love sex." A mistake of fact defense is an issue when some evidence has been admitted that the members might rely upon if they choose to. That threshold was clearly passed in this case, and the military judge erred by not giving the instruction of mistake of fact. Not only did he err by not giving the instruction, but he relied upon erroneous case law in doing so. The military judge's error was constitutional error, and as a result, the government must show that the failure to give the instruction was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The error here was catastrophic. As a result, the maltreatment specifications should be set aside, which then represents a major change in the findings landscape and removes any confidence we have as to what the judged or approved sentence would have been absent those convictions.
Counsel, can I ask you a question? Is consent a defense to the maltreatment charges, or is it simply a factor in the totality of the circumstances for the objective test? And does it matter?
Your Honor, that's two separate questions. I think when we look at consent, as far as the specifications of maltreatment, our courts have considered that we look at the totality of the circumstances in each situation with regard to the evidence. And one of the things that we looked at that Fuller annotated was that we specifically look at the subordinate's consent or lack of consent in that situation when looking at findings. However, separate to that is the idea that whether there was or was not consent on part of the individual, the evidence may rise the mistake of fact defense, where even if the subordinate did not give consent, if there was a reasonable belief on the part of the appellant that there was consent given, that stands as a defense, a mistake of fact defense to the charge of maltreatment.
So, counsel, your argument is even though consent is not a defense, it's only a fact from the totality of the circumstances, that mistake of fact as to consent is a defense?
Yes, Your Honor. And when establishing this mistake of fact defense, we first look at what the RCM, and we look at RCM 920, required instruction, it's 920E, that instruction shall include a description of any special defense under RCM 916. And if we turn to 916J, it is a defense to an offense that the accused held as a result of ignorance or mistake, an incorrect belief of the true circumstances, that such if the circumstances were as the accused believed him, the accused would not be guilty of that offense. And this specific idea was highlighted in U.S. v. Garcia, a CAF case, which the court ruled that a mistake of fact is a defense to the charge of maltreatment.
In Garcia, the court held that that mistake of fact as to consent must both be subjectively held and objectively reasonable. What evidence is there on the record of the objective reasonableness of the appellant's belief as to consent?
Your Honor, the record is replete with examples of the objective reasonableness of a mistake of fact. I think the first two things we look at is, number one, evidence came out of the accused mutual hugging and kissing with C.H. In addition to that, before going to the specific facts of the case, which I'll highlight, I think it's important to look at the fact that there was a 120 specification in this case. And with the 120 specification, the parties requested and agreed that a mistake of fact instruction would be appropriate for that case. So I think we look to at least the subject of intent there to get over that hurdle. As far as the objective intent of what we can look at the case, I think simply we look at the interaction between the appellant here and the two females. I talked about a few examples in the beginning with the amount of text messages and the one of the comments by C.H., but there's numerous other examples. C.H. had testified that she specifically believed that the appellant had misperceived her intentions.
So all this evidence goes to the subjective belief that the appellant may have had about the subordinate's consent. In Garcia, which you cite and discuss, the court held that there was no evidence, though, of the objective reasonableness of the belief. Now, I recognize that was in a different context of the guilty plea, but what evidence on the record was introduced that an objectively reasonable person would have thought that the belief as to consent was reasonable in the circumstances?
Your Honor, we look at the record and the vast amount of the examples of the interaction between the two women and the appellant. And a outside person looking at those facts and circumstances could believe that there was a mistake of fact as to the appellant's belief. And it goes back to the idea for under 917 for a mistake of fact defense to be raised. There just has to be some evidence.
But it's the reasonableness of the appellant's belief that we're looking at objectively, correct? Are you suggesting that a chief master sergeant, that an objective person could reasonably believe that a chief master sergeant should expect an E3 to consent to these propositions? Is that a reasonable belief to be held? Not by the chief, but by an outside observer.
Yes, Your Honor. And our case law is very clear that rank disparity does not make maltreatment a per se or a strict liability offense. Again, we go back and we look at the totality of the circumstances. Now, is that something that we look at? Do we look at the fact that there is a rank disparity there? And do we consider that in that totality of circumstances analysis? Yes, we do. But we also have to look at all of the other circumstances. Here there was two E4s, one girl that promoted to E5. And if we go back and look at the record of their interactions, the photos that they sent to him, the comments that they made on the stand as to whether or not, or the fact that they believe that he did misperceive their intentions. The fact
Does
that
their response matter?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if a chief master sergeant asks a significant subordinate, send me a picture of your private area, is that maltreatment?
It's not a yes or no question, Your Honor.
Is it reasonable to assume, are you suggesting that it's reasonable for a chief master sergeant to form a belief that for them to consent to that response was a reasonable, that they would consent willingly, that that's a reasonable belief to hold?
Yes, Your Honor. Looking at the totality of the circumstances, looking at how the different parties interacted, yes, it is. But that's also only one part of the question. The consent portion is to the findings of whether or not these females could have given consent. When we're looking at, under 917, a mistake of fact instruction, we're just looking at the fact, is there some evidence that the triers of fact could rely on to believe that the appellant was under a mistaken belief? And here, the facts that we've articulated, is that that small minutia of some evidence, that scintilla of evidence needed for the judge to instruct the members of that additional information that they consider. And again, the same rank disparity was involved in the 120 case with the wrongful sexual contact. And there, the members were given the mistake of fact instruction. In fact, they even came back on the record to say that we have decided 5 of the 6 specifications, but we need some elaboration from the court regarding this mistake of fact instruction. The judge provided that additional instruction, and 20 minutes later, they came back with an acquittal in relation to that 120 charge.
I hijacked Judge Weber's line of questioning, so you probably want to go back to that. So what evidence is there that the appellant has asserted that this was a reasonable belief, that given their rank disparity, that it was reasonable for him to presume consent to his proposition?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
But what evidence is there? What evidence was introduced at trial, not on the subjective belief, but on the objective reasonableness of the appellant's belief?
Your Honor, the objective reasonableness, again, is that we look at the totality of the circumstances, and we look at the fact that the female sent pictures of their bodies. Most of the time, not in response, it's not like the appellant here was constantly asking for specific body shots. He would ask for pictures, and they would, at their own discretion, send these nude or half-nude photos. We have different comments by, for example, by AR that said, I was just trying to keep him where I knew that he wasn't. Like, he didn't think I was mad at him or anything, that we had a good relationship. The fact that AR, after becoming upset with him, finally told him, leave me alone. Like, I don't want to have any more correspondence with you. I want everything, I want this to change. And she testified that after that, there was no other text or comments or exchange with the appellant. She told him what she wanted, and he did that. And it's interesting that months after that, AR applied for a job within the chief's section as the assistant to his exec. And also after she had jaw surgery, the appellant's wife had offered for her to convalesce at their home. And she took advantage of that, and she convalesced there while the gurneys took care of her. And she testified at trial that this was all after she asked him, for those messages to stop. And during all that time that she spent with Chief Gurney, there was no additional instances. So in addition, we look at CH. She testified that, she believed the appellant had misperceived her intentions, that he thought, in her mind, that she was just reciprocating the interest in his text messages.
Counsel, let me just give you a short synopsis and just ask me as directly as you can. Chief Master Sergeant tells the E4, Saturday morning, wash my car and mow my lawn. Nothing to do with duties. If the E4 says no or yes, that determines whether or not the chief's statements were maltreatment? Is that your position?
Your Honor, I think when we look at the consent of the individual, as our court said, it's a totality of the circumstances test.
So let me give the totality. They say they show up and they wash the car and mow the lawn.
Then the consent is one of the things that the trier of fact would be able to consider in deciding whether maltreatment occurred.
Isn't that what the judge instructed the members to do, exactly that, taken into account?
Yes, Your Honor, but it goes back to, there's two separate questions here. The first question pertains to finding whether or not the maltreatment occurred. And consent is one of the things that the members can consider.
Is it a factor or is it a defense? Let's go back to that a little bit. Is it a factor? Isn't the essence of the maltreatment crime the abuse of power of the accused?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So in the maltreatment, you can also have things like a commander who yells and shouts at his people, correct? I mean, that could, in some way, could end up being maltreatment if it was done inappropriately, right?
I suppose it could, Your Honor.
All right, so if that's, so let's look at the offense of maltreatment. Would consent be a defense to that if the subordinates stood there and took the beating from their commander? Would consent ever be a defense? It would, wouldn't.
I'm not sure I completely understand your question.
Well, I think we need to distinguish between a maltreatment case and a sexual assault case. And the analysis that we've been looking at in this case so far seems to be kind of like what we would do in a sexual assault. But I think we need to look at what maltreatment is all about. And it's about abuse of power, asking somebody to come over and mow their lawn, doing things you're not supposed to do as a commander. So my question is, in those circumstances, when would consent ever be a defense?
Well, Your Honor, I think I can answer that. And what it is this. At first, we look at consent as one of the factors in the totality of the circumstances of determining whether maltreatment occurred.
Okay, it's a factor or is it a defense?
It is both.
Do you see a distinction between those two?
I do, Your Honor. It stands as both.
Okay.
The first step is it's a factor in looking at whether the alleged act did or did not occur. So we have a case law that says when we're looking at the subordinate's consent, it is not a per se crime or strict liability. We have to look at that. The members can find that they believe, you know, that the subordinate did not consent, and they can find the individual guilty of that crime. The second layer of that, though, comes in as to the mistake of fact consent. If there is feigned consent on the part of the subordinate where members find that the appellant did or did not, or excuse me, that the subordinate did not consent, the mistake of fact defense comes in and serves as a defense to the appellant, where the appellant can say, okay, you found here that the subordinate didn't consent, but look at all of the evidence put forth, you can find that there is a reasonable mistake on the part of the appellant as to the belief of the subordinate's consent, and that serves as a defense, which would negate the crime.
Counsel, so this mistake of fact, I'm sorry, just one last question. Does mistake of fact apply when consent is only a factor and not a defense?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that one more time?
If consent is only a factor and not an actual defense, then how does mistake of fact as to consent apply?
Via 917, Your Honor, this is a general intent crime. And U.S. v. Carson, 57 MJ 410, has classified maltreatment as a general intent offense.
Counsel, let me ask you along those lines. You had earlier pointed us to 916J. The last sentence there says, however, if the accused knowledge or intent is immaterial as to an element, then ignorance or mistake is not a defense. So what is the accused knowledge or intent regarding consent, or what element is it material to? if it's only a factor to consider in the totality of the circumstances as opposed to an element?
And that's just it, Your Honor. Part of that totality of the circumstances, it's a general intent crime. So part of that being a general intent crime, we look at the appellant's subjective view. That's what the courts have identified. The courts have identified that maltreatment is a general intent crime, which then establishes that we need to look at the intent of the appellant in this case.
So what does it mean when the Article 93 itself says in the paragraph 17C that you measure it from an objective standard? Then what does that mean? Can you clarify that for me? What does that mean when Judge Cumby said, I'm going to instruct that it from an objective standard and it's a factor to consider? So he followed the bench book instruction. He seemed to follow paragraph 17C. What does it mean when it says an objective standard?
Well, ma'am, I think the two cases that best highlight how we look at maltreatment are U.S. v. Carson and U.S. v. Fuller. They seem to give the best guidance as to kind of an interpretation of the MCM in the judge's bench book. And it goes back to in Carson that they call it an objective evaluation of the totality of the circumstances that represents the appropriate mode of analysis in the particular case. So I think we start there. And I think we also look at Fuller, which has highlighted the fact that maltreatment is not a strict liability offense. You know, we look at the subjective and objective intent of both the accused and the subordinate in each individual situation. And I think we go back to Carson, where, again, it was established that, Article 93 is a general intent crime. So we can infer from that also the intent that we're looking at on the part of the appellant or the accused.
Counsel, would you agree that in addition to the alleged victim in a maltreatment case, that the government is also kind of a victim of a maltreatment that's designed, I guess what Article 93 is designed to do is to protect good order and discipline, protect the not have abuse of authority. So there's a governmental interest in Article 93. Would you agree with that?
To a certain extent, yes, sir.
Okay, and you did concede earlier that Article 93 was designed to deal with an abuse of authority, correct?
Yes, sir.
Now, my question is this. If you have an individual, an airman, who's in a situation where they're being maltreated, isn't there, because of the abuse of authority, because of the disparity in rank, isn't there an inherent incentive on their part to pretend like they're going along with it? Because, in a sexual harassment situation or a quid pro quo type sexual harassment situation, they're concerned about their career, so they don't want to upset this person. They may be in a situation where it kind of inherent in the situation is them giving off signals that would make the accused think that they can send it. At the same time, it doesn't diminish the wrongfulness of the behavior.
If I might just add the phrase you may be looking for, Judge Reedy, to draw language from the case you cited, Fuller, it's based on the unique situation of dominance and control.
Well, Your Honor, I know you draw a parallel to sexual assault cases, and within sexual assault cases...
No, I wouldn't draw a parallel to sexual assault cases. So that's not what...
Okay.
I'm talking about a sexual harassment, a quid pro quo sexual harassment, hostile work environment, those under an Article 93.
I apologize, Your Honor. I thought you were akinning it to something along the constructive force theory.
No.
Which...
No, mine would be the abuse of authority in this situation, which I think is what Article 93 is meant to deal with, that it would cause someone, would you not agree, might cause a victim to give off signals that would appear as though they were consenting? And should there really be a mistake of fact consent, defense, excuse me, in this case, under those circumstances?
Yes, Your Honor. And when I think that's one of the things that a trier of fact would most certainly consider when we look at the totality of circumstances. You know, is the subordinate in a position where they could have resisted? Or did they completely acquiesce because of that rank disparity? But, Your Honor, I think we do need to be careful, because what we don't want to describe is a situation which the courts have said we don't want to get to, where it's a per se offense or it's a strict liability offense. And by taking the mistake of fact out of that analysis, we're then making it almost a strict liability defense or a per se offense, that just because there is a rank disparity between two individuals, that that automatically constitutes maltreatment. And that's, the courts have been very clear on this. That what we're describing may constitute some other offense under the UCMJ, but as we've articulated, especially with Article 93, it is important within our military justice system, and the courts have been clear that they want the crime of maltreatment to be applied in the correct circumstances. And Your Honor, I'm out of time, if I may continue.
You may.
And by drawing those lines that it is not a strict liability for defense or per se, then we do get to consider rank disparity, but again, it's not an end game. We go back and we look at the situation and the interactions between the accused and the subordinate to see if maltreatment did or did not occur.
If I may ask, follow. Let's say we accept your argument. We find that he should have instructed on mistake of fact. And you would assert that it was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. So what would you have us do? What's the remedy?
Your Honor, the remedy here is to set aside the maltreatment specifications and to decide whether there should be a retrial as to findings or whether a rehearing should be appropriate as far as sentencing. And it's interesting when you look at, when you take away the two maltreatment specifications here, looking at, there was other specifications. There was 15 total that he was found guilty of. But when the two maltreatment, we can all agree are by far the most egregious of what he was convicted of. And it's interesting to see what the government thought of their sentencing case at trial. When the government was giving their sentencing argument, there was 9 females alleged in the specifications. The government almost, without exception, focused on the 2 females in the maltreatment specifications, AR and CH. Now, mind you, AR and CH are not listed in any of the other government specifications that he was found guilty of. So if you take the maltreatment away, they are no longer part of this game.
Despite that, is there any reasonable probability that the members would have come back with a sentence less than what was ultimately approved in this case?
I think certainly, Your Honor. By far, again, the maltreatment were the most serious offense, where we actually have an allegation of, or found guilty of, the appellant kind of preying on subordinates. The other violations were, a multitude of 92 and 134 violations relating to adultery. So maltreatment was by far the most serious. And I go back to the sentencing argument, where out of the 13 pages of the sentencing argument, 9 pages were solely focused to maltreatment or the 2 women in the maltreatment charges. The other 4 pages were just more or less a canned government sentencing argument. Out of the 15 charges, the sole argument was focused on the 2 maltreatment.
Let's say we find otherwise, and we find that there is no reasonable probability that the members would have adjudged less than what was ultimately approved in this case. Is there any reason why we could not, in the interest of judicial economy, simply dismiss those specifications and reassess to the same sentence that was ultimately approved?
And let me add a tag on to that. Are we limited to what was approved? So are we limited, if we reassess, to 4 months and a BCD and E1, or E4?
Yes, Your Honor, it was the approved sentence. Off the top of my head, I can't cite to what I'm relying upon, but I believe that would be the...
That's the cap.
The cap.
So then to his question...
Could we not, if we find that the members would not have adjudged less than what was approved in this case, could we not simply dismiss those specifications and reassess to the same sentence? Is there any reason we could not do that?
Your Honor, I don't know if there's a prohibition against it, but I would say that I don't believe that outcome by this court would be consistent with the DePaul case, where in that case, almost identical facts and circumstances to what's playing out here, that the court determined that there was no certainty that they could reassess the sentence in light of the dismissal of the charges in that case. So in that case, they were remanded.
So you're saying the sentencing landscape would change enough that we couldn't reassess? That's your argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Major Warren.
Chief Judge Warren, honorable members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Major Charles Warren, and along with Colonel Don Christensen, we have the honor of representing the United States government in this case. Your Honor's maltreatment punishes the abuse of rank and position. CAF has stated that the essence of maltreatment is the abuse of power. Appellant seeks to flee from the objective standard of maltreatment because it exists to prevent debauched senior NCOs, like appellant, from serving as their own deluded judge and jury concerning the appropriateness of their actions to their subordinates. Accordingly, this court did not err in its prior two decisions in this case because, first, there is no affirmative defense of mistake of fact as to maltreatment, and this court is so held in United States v. Hansen, ASCMR, 1990. Second, dicta does not disturb precedent. And dicta by a superior court in Garcia and an unpublished decision in the Navy does not serve as precedent for this court. And finally, third, the egregious conduct of appellant in this case rendered any error trial harmless. Even if it was error for the military judge not to instruct on mistake of fact in relation to the maltreatment offense, the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because the government's case was exceptionally strong. It is clear from the record below who was the aggressor and who was the party being acted upon. This is not a circumstance of a starstruck junior enlisted woman wantonly pursuing a senior enlisted leader. Rather, this is a circumstance where a command chief master sergeant sought to leverage his rank and influence to seduce junior enlisted members within his sphere of influence.
Okay, if I may.
Ma'am.
So I know you're arguing that Garcia is dicta.
Yes, ma'am.
But how can we ignore the language that CAF has provided in there? It seems to some of us anyway that the language in Garcia in the Providency Inquiry really was what the decision kind of hung on. I mean, they analyzed the reasonableness of his comments to make a decision about the Providency Inquiry, and that related back to their language, it seems to me anyway, about mistake of fact is a defense and a general intent crime.
Well, ma'am, at most, we don't say that you ignore Garcia. You place Garcia in the proper context, and you do that in a couple of ways. First off, by understanding what was the granted issue in Garcia, and that was the providency of the plea. And at most, all CAF did was assume without deciding, as indeed it did not need to decide, the applicability of a mistake of fact instruction there because they found, at any rate, if one might have applied, it didn't apply because the facts didn't raise it. So CAF never directly ruled on the applicability of a mistake of fact instruction in Garcia.
Did they say in Garcia that they were assuming that the defense applied?
No, Your Honor, they did not specifically say that they were assuming. They said that here, all that the accused did was express a subjective belief and that that subjective belief couldn't meet any objective belief anyway. But what they held, what the narrow issue was by the Judge General of the United States Air Force was, was the plea trial where the accused evinced some subjective mistake of fact? And that answer back was yes, it was provident. They did not need to answer and did not answer whether a reasonable mistake of fact would obtain. The second thing is that Garcia is placed in the context by Fuller and Carson. What Fuller and Carson expressly hold, Fuller, first off, that consent is not a defense, but it's a factor to be taken in the totality of the circumstances for whether maltreatment occurred. And third, Carson importantly decided after both Fuller and Garcia, Garcia 1996, Fuller 2000, Carson 2002, reaffirming the importance of evaluating the essence of dominance and control of the rank structure, totality of the circumstances in evaluating maltreatment, and most importantly, an objective standard for evaluating that. The court said, we conclude that an objective evaluation of the totality of the circumstances represents the appropriate mode of analysis under Article 93 UCMJ, and that is Carson 57 MJ at 415. It is emphatically clear that whatever dicta CAF might have been contemplating in Garcia has not been followed by its subsequent precedent, and Carson makes clear that it is, was, and ever shall be an objective standard for maltreatment under Article 93 UCMJ.
You said, if I heard you right, consent is not a defense.
Correct, Your Honor. It is not a defense. It's a factor to be taken into account in the totality of the circumstances, as the court described in Fuller.
In this case, if the junior airman, the chief had said, I'd like to get pictures of you, I'd like to send pictures of you, is that okay? And she said, that's fine, chief. Do we have an offense of maltreatment?
Potentially, we still could have an offense of maltreatment, Your Honor. We have to consider the totality of the circumstances and the rank disparity.
He had a one-time meeting with her, and he says, Airman, I find you very attractive. I'd like to send you pictures of me. Would you reciprocate and send pictures of yourself? That's the extent of what we have. And she says, that's no problem. She likes the attention. She's not particularly bothered by the rank structure. Is that maltreatment?
Your Honor, I think that the finder of fact would be a verdict that could be upheld on appeal that is maltreatment, that the finder of fact, in considering the inherent nature of the rank structure in the military
environment. Then you just read a per se violation.
No, Your Honor, it's not a per se violation.
Hang on a second. You just said that the airman who has given her okay and has said, I have no problem with this, has not indicated that she is somehow bothered or influenced or any of the other requirements under Article 93 has consented.
Well, Your Honor, the
argument, without it being a defense, it sounds like you're making it a per se violation, which the case law says Article 30 or 93 is not a per se violation.
Your Honor, Your Honor, the government agrees that Article 93 is not a per se violation. The government just reiterates that in considering the totality of the circumstances, CAF has repeatedly held, and they discussed this in Carson, the most recent case directly on point cited by the parties in this case, that the influence of dominion and control and rank is something that must be considered in the totality of the circumstances, and that's why even in the hypothetical that you offer, Your Honor, the finder of fact would be entitled to conclude as a matter of law that there was maltreatment in that case, even if there was acquiescence by a victim. But most importantly, this court, these are decidedly not the facts in this case, far from the facts in this case. In this case, what we have is the appellant wanted to talk about text messages. Well, the question isn't how many, but when. And what the record clearly indicates in this case is that those text messages continue after both of the victims, C-H and A-R, either quit texting or definitively told the chief, stop. For C-H, quit texting mid-September. He continues to send text messages. This is Defense Exhibit U through November, including on the very day that he's calling
the police on. The reasonableness of whether or not it's raised. Well, let's go back to the actual offense of maltreatment a little bit. I kind of discussed it with appellate defense. Let's change the facts just a little bit so we can understand the offense a little bit. We've got a command chief. Let's say this command chief, instead of a senior airman, it's actually a senior master sergeant or another chief who's maybe a group chief who's subordinate to him because he's the command chief. Are you saying, is the government's position that the command chief's not allowed to have a consensual sexual relationship with anybody under his orders?
Your Honor, the government's position is that any command chief engaging in those types of interactions needs to behave professionally, and that even consensual interactions can be maltreatment. It's not, we're not here to make a categorical rule.
Is it possible that he could have a consensual relationship with another person on the installation?
It's possible that he could have a consensual relationship. Sure, Your Honor, it's possible he could have a consensual relationship. The issue of whether that rose to the level of maltreatment would have to be evaluated.
So how do we know if the relationship, if you're looking at it from the chief's perspective, how do you know that if he's having what he presumes to be a typical, normal relationship, consensual relationship with this senior master sergeant, or another chief for that matter, how do we know if it's pursuant to his maltreatment, or is it an actual consensual relationship? I mean, if he thinks it's an actual consensual relationship, then there wouldn't mistake of fact then apply.
No, sir. The reason it would not apply is because maltreatment is evaluated under an objective standard. So it does not matter that the chief thought this was all good. And indeed, maltreatment is designed to prevent senior NCOs like Chief Master Sergeant Gurney, who offered the self-serving epithet, "Now if I get too flirtatious, you just tell me." That's not the standard. That's not the standard. It's not for the E4 to put the E9 in line. That's why maltreatment exists, to prevent this type of self-serving abuse of power. The objective standard ensures that it's neither the appellant's perspective, that it would be too generous a standard, nor the recipient's perspective, which would be perhaps too lenient a standard, because you'd have circumstances where someone might come up and say, "Major Warren, I thought you did a great job in that oral argument, but I sensed the tone, and I felt I'd been being maltreated because my superior gave me a tone." Well, that's not the standard either. The standard is an objective third-party standard, and it exists to make sure that Air Force values and professional behavior continue on, and that the chief does not get a veto over when that happens. So in the hypothetical you gave, sir, with a senior master sergeant and a chief master sergeant in the same command engaged in a consensual sexual relationship, the law says, under Fuller, that we look at that in the totality of the circumstances. And while not rising to the level of a defense, an objective person could consider whether the nature of that consensual relationship took it out of the realm of being oppressive, cruel, or maltreatment under those circumstances. In this case, that's decidedly not the circumstances. But before I move on,
let me ask you, if consent, your position is consent is not a defense, but it is a factor.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
So why is mistake of fact as to consent not a factor? And shouldn't the members have been instructed that mistake of fact as to consent was a factor as well?
Yes, Your Honor, they should not be instructed as such, primarily because the objective test removes the accused's perspective from governing whether maltreatment occurred. This is directly opposite from a sexual assault case. Directly opposite. In a sexual assault case, and this is where appellant syllogism fails, for wrongful sexual contact, the elements of consent, one, exist. Consent's an element to begin with. Second, there, it's would a reasonable person interacting with that victim perceive his advances as being received with consent. That's not the standard in maltreatment. And if consent is not a defense, as CAF has held that it is not, Fuller does not say consent's a defense. If consent's not a defense, and that's the superior, how can the inferior be a defense? If consent's not even a defense, how possibly could mistake of fact be a defense? How could the lesser be greater? It doesn't make sense.
Would still mistake of fact be part of the totality of the circumstances, and that the members should have been instructed that mistake of fact in their objective, in their determination of the objective standard is one of the factors for consideration, much like consent is one of the factors?
No, sir, it should not, because the element under maltreatment is to be determined under the objective test. It's not to be determined from the victim's perspective. It's not to be determined from the chief's perspective. Because it's that objective third-party observer, and that objective third-party observer is unaffected by what their the subjective interactions, as the court said in Hansen, this court said in Hansen that the subjective perceptions of the accused have no bearing on maltreatment. That's the reason why, sir. The third-party objective standard is why maltreatment is not subject to a mistake of fact instruction.
But I can't get away from your argument saying that anytime you have an E9 proposition and an E3 in this way.
Sir, that's not our argument.
Well, what I'm saying is, if you had that situation, whether she consented or not, even though it's a factor, how do you ever get past the reasonableness? If she's as willing as you can get, she's absolutely head over heels for this guy, willing to do it, under your argument, you would say under an objective standard, no E-9 could ever ask that of an E-3 without maltreating her in the process.
Sir, we're not saying that he could not ask that. We're saying that at trial, a finder of fact, being presented with that evidence, could decide it one of two ways. They could decide that maltreatment occurred, and that would be upheld under the law. They could also decide that maltreatment did not occur in light of that consent, and that would be upheld under the law. So we're not saying it's categorical that it's maltreatment in every case. We're saying that the most the defense gets is what CAF has said, which is consent is considered as a factor, not a defense, because allowing that to be a defense would overwhelm the objective standard that the offense has established as an element. And that objective standard exists to protect Air Force values from a veto by the accused or even by the victim. It's the Air Force values that govern. It's the objective standard that governs, not the actors at play.
How is a mistake of fact defense inconsistent with the objective standard when an objective standard is built into the mistake of fact defense? Aren't you looking at the same issues, whether the accused's subjective belief that she consented was reasonable in the circumstances, given the totality of the circumstances, given the rank disparity, given the situation into which the communications arose?
Yes, sir. They are not the same objective person, Your Honor, because in the mistake of fact defense, the language from 916J1, if the circumstances were as the accused believe, the accused would not be guilty of the offense. That's an objective person in the shoes of the accused. The objective standard under maltreatment is not an objective person in the shoes of the accused. It's a third-party objective person perceiving this. So whereas the usual mistake of fact defense expressly incorporates the accused, maltreatment expressly disassociates and makes it a third party. That's the government's reading of the plain language of the MCM describing the objective standard for maltreatment, sir.
So it would be like somebody looking in from the outside?
Yes, ma'am.
The behavior of both parties?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. That's what the objective standard is, and that's how it's been described by CAF and Carson.
So the
Your Honor?
Go ahead.
Let me see if I can, if I've distilled what I understand your argument to be, and correct me if I have this wrong. If it's a defense as opposed to a factor, then the military judge must instruct on it as a special defense under RCM 920, correct?
Yes, sir.
In this case, because no third party could be reasonably mistaken as to the victim's consent, it did not, therefore, raise the requirement to specifically instruct on it under 920.
Well, yes, sir, I'd say that's part of it. I would agree with that, that the not raised piece, but I would go a step further and say not eligible. Not only not raised, like if it is a defense, it wouldn't be raised, and the government will get to that, and it's part two of its argument, but we'd say it's not eligible because a third party doesn't entertain mistake of fact. A third party is just viewing all the totality of the circumstances, and that's why CAF permitted that third party to consider consent in Fuller, but did not make consent a defense. It's a factor, not a defense.
Ignorance of mistake of fact is listed as a defense under 916J, right?
Yes, sir. It's generally available as a defense, but here the elements of maltreatment take it out of the realm of defenses because the objective person is not the accused.
So you're saying you only get an instruction on a special defense if intent is a specifically enumerated element to the offense?
Well, Your Honor, we're saying that in this case, because of the element structure of maltreatment that it takes out. This is similar to a circumstance with fraternization. The mistake of fact is not a defense to fraternization. It's not a mistake of fact that the accused thought, well, I didn't think I was getting too familiar with that enlisted person. That's not an element. That's not a defense. Similarly,
if a reasonable person under the circumstances could consider defense raised by some of the evidence, would the accused in that situation not be entitled to an instruction under 916J and 920?
Yes, sir. But that's distinguished between if evidence raises an eligible defense, the accused is entitled to that defense. The government's position is that mistake of fact is not an eligible defense for maltreatment based upon the objective person standard as described by the statute and then as interpreted by CAF, most recently again in Carson, describing it again as we conclude an objective evaluation of the totality of the circumstances represents the appropriate mode of analysis under Article 93 UCMJ.
So
And again, it sounds like what you're saying is it's not eligible here because the proposition that a person in the chief's position could be reasonably, or could be mistaken, is just so patently unreasonable.
Well,
is that what you're saying?
That is part of what we're saying, yes, sir. We are saying that even if it was eligible, that it's patently unreasonable in this case based upon these facts, so there would still be no error in not giving it. But we're going further and saying in the first instance, he did not qualify for mistake of fact instruction because no mistake of fact defense exists for maltreatment. The court has never held as such. The furthest the court has gone is to say that consent is a factor to be considered in the totality of the circumstances, and that's the Fuller case where the court found, and this is very important to distinguish from this case, Your Honor. In Fuller, the court found that an E2 having sex with an E5 did not constitute maltreatment, where the E2 testified at trial that the disparity in rank and authority had no influence on her desire to have sex with the E5. Contrasting here, where we have both victims testifying extensively on the record, and those sites are included at the government brief, I won't repeat them ad nauseum now, that these were unwelcome advances, that they stopped communicating with the chief, that he then continued to initiate and send nude and semi-nude pictures of himself, and continued that practice.
Could you explain how the Di Paola case applies?
Yes, Your Honor. And the Di Paola case, the court held that the failure to give a mistake of fact consent instruction was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, where the military judge gave an instruction and the accused was acquitted of, I believe it was in the same case of an indecent exposure charge and then convicted of the sex assault charge. There, though, the court found that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because the lack of an instruction, quote, the missing instruction essentially undercut a defense theory and could very well have contributed to a finding of guilty. So therefore, not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because it didn't allow the defense to present a theory. Here, the defense got the chance to present their theory. They fully presented it. The members just weren't buying it. And they weren't buying it because multiple factors that I'd like to hand for the court here. First, the accused acknowledged he was wrong. Second, the pursuit of Junior Aaron was full of aggravating circumstances. And third, chief's credibility was shot by the time that they arrived at trial. And I'll briefly delineate some reasons for each of those larger reasons. First
Maybe
off,
I
the
could
accused,
just help you
yes,
along
ma'am.
Here. So how do you reconcile the fact that the members, with respect to the wrongful sexual contact, the 120 offense, of which they were instructed on mistake of fact, came back with questions about consent. So how do you reconcile Di Paola to say there wasn't any kind of bleed over into the other maltreatment offense?
Yes, ma'am. Very glad you asked that question because it's important to dismiss the defense's simplistic syllogism here. And there's four reasons. One, different time frame. Two, different misconduct. Three, different elements. Four, different perspective. And in stepping through this is not a Di Paola situation where we have two sex assaults with the two same perspectives. This is a maltreatment and a sex assault case. So let's go to the first of the time frame. We're talking about different behavior here. It's 1 through 31 August 2009 for the Article 120, and we're talking about 1 July through 13 November 2009 for the Article 93. So we've got conduct that goes beyond. It's not the same conduct. So a mistake of fact as to whether the chief fondled the breast and buttocks of Senior Airman CH is not dispositive of whether he maltreated her by continuing to send nude and semi-nude pictures of himself before, during, and after that time frame. Second, the misconduct, we just touched upon that. Third, the elements. Lack of consent is an element of wrongful sexual contact. It is not an element of maltreatment, and indeed is not intended to be so, because as this court said in Hansen, subordinates are entitled to protection from maltreatment against their superiors. They shouldn't have to invoke it. The burden is on the superior, not the subordinate. And fourth, the different perspective, which we've just been discussing. Most important, Your Honor, the perspective under an Article 120 wrongful sexual contact is a reasonable mistake of fact because it's with a person in the position of the accused have interpreted her actions to be consensual. And Congress expressly held under Article 120 that mistake of fact was an affirmative defense, and then obviously for wrongful sexual contact, it's an actual element, so it serves as a defense and affirmative defense. In maltreatment, that is not the case. Congress has not made a specific finding that a mistake of fact instruction will lay where it's not the accused perspective that's being evaluated, but the objective observer. So to sum it up, ma'am, the reason why an instruction on wrongful sexual contact does not yield acquittal on maltreatment is because the perspectives are different, and the objective observer is not the accused. The objective observer is a third party looking in. The instructions are inapposite to each other.
Counsel, I want to go back to Judge Weber's question, and that is, for a mistake of fact in a general intent offense, doesn't it require both a subjective, that the mistake be honest, and then as well as an objective, that it be a reasonable mistake? So you keep referring to that mistake of fact as solely a subjective defense, but isn't it actually overall an objective defense in this case?
Oh, sir, yes, we agree as a general precept, sir. Mistake of fact is the subjective and objective. Subjectively, that the accused believed that the person was consenting, and objectively, that a reasonable person in the shoes of the accused would have believed that she was consenting. But that's not who the objective observer is in a maltreatment case, sir. The objective observer is a third party, not the accused. And that's why the mistake of fact instruction does not apply, because his intent, the accused's intent, does not govern the perspective of that third party observer. Now, as we've appreciate the court's questions on this, I feel like we've thoroughly covered whether it applies as a defense. Assuming arguendo that this court should find that the mistake of fact as to consent was a defense in this case, any failure to give the instruction was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because of the overwhelming strength of the government's case. And here I'd like to step through what I was briefly discussing before. There was no harmfulness here because no reasonable likelihood that a fact finder would have concluded that a reasonable person would have thought the appellant's lecherous advances towards these airmen was not maltreatment. First off, forget about reasonable mistake of fact. The accused admitted to lack of subjective mistake of fact. Quote, in hindsight, knowing what I know now, I obviously crossed a line that I should not have crossed. That's Prosecution Exhibit 6 at 31. Quote, that doesn't excuse me from crossing the line, not me, and not in the position that I'm in. Prosecution Exhibit 6 at 32. In hindsight, in the position I'm in the position she's in, I should have seen this train wreck coming. Prosecution Exhibit 6 at 33. Here's the important thing to keep in mind with all these statements, Your Honors. This isn't some distant reflection by the chief. This is contemporaneous with his most recent maltreatment misconduct. Hours before, he had sent a picture of his new exposed penis in his ABUs at his desk at the Air Force Materiel Command to a non-desirous senior airman, CH. This isn't a distant reflection. This is contemporaneous with the misconduct. This is acknowledgement of wrong, contemporaneous with the misconduct, and directly relevant to this case, and no reasonable finder of fact would have found that he had any mistake as to what the propriety of his actions. Now, secondly, the appellant's pursuit of the junior airman is full of aggravating circumstances. First, he initiated the texting. That's Prosecution Exhibit 6 at 28. Second, he initiated the sexting. That's Prosecution Exhibit 6 at 22. Third, he was the predominant one with the sexting. That's Prosecution Exhibit 6 at 32. He asked for pictures. Contrary to appellant counsel's assertions here, he asked for pictures. And of senior airman AR, he specifically, and excuse my language, but it's the words of the accused, of the appellant, abs, pussy, ass. He asked senior airman CH, you want some help in your humanitarian assignment? Send me a pic. He asked for pictures. He sent them unsolicited pictures. Next, he sent a semi-nude pic from his 25th wedding anniversary trip from Hawaii with his wife. That's Prosecution Exhibit 6 at 37, and he sent that to both senior airman AR. And here's the important point. She testified they had a knock-it-off, loud, yelling, cussing match argument in March 2009. He sends this in July 2009 with no interaction in the meantime. That's maltreatment. And similarly with senior airman CH, he sent this pic to her unsolicited. And finally, as I just was discussing before, the picture in his ABUs from his desk with his penis exposed, Prosecution Exhibit 6 at 38. And how did the chief greet all this? With contemptible self-pity that was also readily available for the members to see. You know, if I was a staff sergeant, no one would really give a shit. probably, you know, because I'm sure this, I'm sure I'm not the only one in the Air Force that has Prosecution Exhibit 6 at 84.
Is Prosecution Exhibit 6 his OSI?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. The full text, and it's 118 pages long. Now, also, beyond this, the chief's credibility, any assertions, self-serving assertions that he made throughout that statement would have been totally undercut by the litany of lies that he unleashed upon his interrogator in his 118-page interview. First, he lied about the scope of the text messages, first saying it was just about Senior Airman CH's request for humanitarian assignment, and then admitting it was sexting purportedly to boost her confidence. That's Prosecution Exhibit 6 at 22. Then he lied about the duration of the text messages, first saying it was only a month, when Defense Exhibit U shows it was for 5 months. Defense Exhibit U. And that's Prosecution Exhibit 6 at 23 and Defense Exhibit U at 3. He lied about the overall number of text messages, saying it was only 50 from her and 50 from him. As we heard the appellant admit here, in Defense Exhibit U shows 854 from him. He lied about the number of flirtatious text messages, saying it was only 10 to 20, when Senior MCH testified as to an incessant stream. That's Prosecution Exhibit 6 to 27. And finally, he lied about sending nude pics, not once, not twice, but three times, about his exposed pubic hair pic from his wedding anniversary pictures, about his full-on nude picture, and also about sending his picture from his desk before he finally admitted all of them. And that's Prosecutor's Exhibit 6 at 37 and 53.
Let's assume that we find error.
Yes,
moving
sir.
From harmless beyond a reasonable doubt to remedy. And let's assume that we do not find that error harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yes, sir.
I asked appellate defense counsel what the remedy is in this case. There's obviously a great difference between the adjudged sentence and the approved sentence. If we find that the error did not impact the sentence that ultimately he was that ultimately was approved in this case, what's your client's position as to the appropriate remedy? Should we send it back, give it back to the Judge Advocate General, to the convening authority to authorize a rehearing on findings, to give the government an opportunity to go back and re-instruct and potentially reconvict him on these offenses? Or should we simply reassess to the sentence that's already been approved?
Yes, Your Honor, and I notice my time has expired. Your Honor, may I answer Judge Walker's question?
Yes.
Thank you, sir. Your Honor, the government's position is that this court is entitled to and should reassess the sentence as approved, because this court can be firmly convinced with a high level of confidence that the members would have approved at least a sentence as severe as 4 months confinement in a BCD in a circumstance where the sentencing landscape only shifted from 16 and a half years to 14 and a half years with the dismissal of the maltreatment. An appellant still stands convicted of 7 unprofessional relationships, 4 instances of adultery that were prejudicial to good order and military discipline, and the indecent conduct in front of another NCO, and the use of his government BlackBerry to send the majority of these texts in this case, meaning that all of the information concerning the lewd text with these senior airmen would have been squarely before the members at sentencing. So the sentencing landscape would not have changed, the sentencing evidence largely would not have changed, and this court can have a high degree of confidence that the appellant would have still received a bad conduct discharge and 4 months confinement. If there are no further questions from the court, Your Honor, may I briefly conclude?
What?
Thank you, Your Honor. Maltreatment is designed as an objective standard to prevent wayward senior NCOs from serving as their own deluded judge and jury at trial. Consent takes on an entirely different tone when colored by the significant influence of enormous rank disparity, and CAF has recognized as much. The government then leaves the court with these words from our superior court from a constructive force case in United States v. Clark, 35 MJ at 436, to demonstrate why there is not and never should be a mistake of fact defense for maltreatment. Quote, an NCO cannot create, by his own actions, an environment of isolation and fear, and then seek excusal from the crime by claiming the absence of force, especially where, as here, persuasive acquiescence is prompted by the unique situation of dominance and control presented by appellant's superior rank and position. In short, maltreatment exists to protect junior airmen, like the victims in this case. From now, Airman Basic, William C.
What was the page number on Clark, 35 MJ?
Yes, Your Honor, 35 MJ 436.
Thank you.
Thank you, Board.
Bench, do you have a vote?
If I may, Your Honor.
Proceed.
Your Honor, we may not like the conduct of the chief in this case, but the conduct does not mean that it was maltreatment, and it does not mean that the military judge should not have instructed on mistake of fact as it pertained to the maltreatment. And it doesn't take away the fact that the military judge not only didn't instruct on it, but in his rationale, he relied upon erroneous case law. CAF has been very clear in U.S. v. Garcia that a mistake of fact defense is applicable in maltreatment cases. Now, the government has cited numerous cases for the proposition that a mistake of fact defense is not applicable, but we need to look at those cases and what they really stand for. Carson was a question of whether in a maltreatment case, whether the government needs to prove actual harm that was sustained to the subordinate. At no point in that case did the defense or the evidence raise a mistake of fact defense. In U.S. v. Fuller, it was a legal sufficiency argument, whether there was legally sufficient evidence to prove the guilt of the appellant in that case. And Fuller directly looked at the fact of consent and that it was not a per se offense. But again, mistake of fact defense was not raised by defense nor looked at by the court. U.S. v. Hansen was a case where the defense asked for a special instruction that a joke should not be construed as maltreatment. Again, they did not ask for a instruction as to mistake of fact, and that was not an issue in that trial. The only case where we can point to where mistake of fact has been relevant is Garcia, and that is the applicable case law that should be applied in this case, and is the applicable case law that should have been applied by the military judge. When defense counsel objected at trial, they asked the military judge.
Let me ask you, how do you distinguish the case of United States versus Springer, Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, 2003, where the court cautions against using an improper subjective standard in their evaluation of why the appellant in that case was convicted of improper performance of body searches against female trainees and was acquitted of one and convicted of, I believe, two others. And the court goes through this analysis and says, we've determined that the members used the appropriate objective standard and did not use the improper subjective standard. Isn't that what you're asking us to do, is to impose the improper subjective standard into the maltreatment cases, which the CAF has cautioned not to do?
Your Honor, the case that we have before us is separate and distinct. We're looking at the maltreatment case, and CAP has said that for a maltreatment case, a general intent offense, that a mistake of fact defense is applicable. That is what CAP has delineated as far as an Article 3 violation. And it's important to look at when we look at the instruction that would be given for a mistake of fact. We're looking at ignorance or a mistake that must have existed in the mind of the accused and must have been reasonable under the circumstances. And we've talked a lot about, obviously, the subjective, but the objective. And it's clear, again, to get that instruction, there just has to be some evidence that is objectively reasonable by someone looking in that this may be a defense. And again, the record is replete with examples of the interactions between the two women and the appellant in this case that would raise that scintilla of some evidence that the military judge should have given this instruction for the members to consider.
And your position is that that's not adequately covered by the military judge's instruction to the members to consider the totality of the circumstances, that he should have specifically delineated a mistake of fact as to consent?
Yes, Your Honor, it's two separate issues. The judge can instruct that a consent, as far as whether the crime was or was not committed, consent is a factor that they consider. But if a mistake of fact as to their consent is raised, the judge must give that additional instruction, and then that becomes a defense for the appellant. And there are two separate issues.
You've used the term scintilla a couple of times. Is that, are you pulling that from case law anywhere, or is that your estimation of what the quantum of evidence must be to necessitate an instruction?
And Your Honor, I'm out of time if I may continue. Your Honor, I don't have a specific case law to cite to, but in case law that's reviewed, scintilla wasn't used, but the courts have talked about the low standard that some evidence is considered, and I think we can draw that distinction that it is tantamount to a scintilla of evidence.
The term used is some evidence, though, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there ever a point at which the evidence is so unreasonable it doesn't constitute some evidence? I mean, a wild accusation may be a scintilla. You know, a wild accusation may be, you know, the tiniest modicum, some showing, but it may not rise to the level of some evidence. Is there a point at which the unreasonability of the evidence proffered would fall below the standard requiring instruction?
Your Honor, I think Garcia spoke to this, and, you know, there's... It must include a subjective belief, but also, you know, that it is reasonable under the circumstances.
So there could be a circumstance wherein the some evidence offered is so unreasonable, the evidence offered is so unreasonable, it doesn't hit that some evidence threshold requiring an instruction.
Your Honor, I couldn't think of a hypothetical, but I draw back to this. I don't think that is the case that we have here. I think there was some evidence, and I think based on all of the facts, it was objectively reasonable that there was a mistake of fact defense.
You'd like to sum up?
If I may, Your Honor. Your Honor, simply put, a reasonable and honest mistake of fact is a defense to maltreatment of a subordinate, and ample evidence supported that the military judge should have given that instruction to the members. Consistent with DiPaola, the maltreatment specifications in this case should be set aside. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to thank both sides for your argument. Very informative. We will take this matter under consideration and will render a decision in due course. We are adjourned.
All rise.